Good evening, everyone. We're opening to Revelation chapter 4, verse 1. And as we're opening to Revelation chapter 4, verse 1, if you got your sheets beforehand, I ask you to do something for me. It was an assignment before this class should ever begin. And that is to compare the contents of this chapter to the contents of Daniel chapter 7, verse 9 through 14. Daniel chapter 7, verse 9 through 14. Like I've been telling you, the Old Testament is going to be the best commentary you have on the book of Revelation for how many allusions and citations there are throughout the Revelation from the Old Testament as it's drawing directly from its themes. So this text in Revelation chapter 4 and Revelation chapter 5 is drawing directly from Daniel chapter 7 and the events found therein. So, I'm going to start by reading in Daniel chapter 7 in verses 9 through 14. And it says, "And as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire, and stream of fire issued and came out from before him, and a thousand thousands served him. And 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And the court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then, because the sound of the great waters that the horn was speaking, or the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. And for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And I saw in the night visions, behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." This is what Daniel saw in the vision in Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 14. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to break this down for me. What events do you see happening in Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 14? First thing that you see is in verses 9 and 10. And in verses 9 and 10, what do you see? Absolutely. He sees a throne scene, and it's the throne scene of the Ancient of Days, which is God. And so you see God on His throne. And surrounding God on His throne, you see a thousand thousands and 10,000 upon 10,000 angels around Him worshiping. The next thing that you see is in verse 11 and 12. And what do you see at that point? The beast being destroyed, the beast being judged. The enemy of the people of God is being judged. That's what's happening. And then after that in verse 13 and 14, what do you see? One like the Son of Man, you see Jesus. Absolutely. This is about Jesus. This is about God, and it's about Jesus. And what's happening to Jesus is he is receiving a kingdom. The glory and the dominion of the Ancient of Days is being passed on to the Son of Man. That's what's happening in this text. So what you're going to see in Revelation chapter 4 and 5 is going to mirror this. What you're going to see is you're going to see a picture of God on His throne. And then you're going to see the Son of Man, Jesus, being crowned King. This is a coronation. And in this coronation, it is a coronation of cosmic proportions in which the ruler of all nations, the ruler over all of the cosmos, is being crowned and praised. And it is the dominion and power being shared between the Ancient of Days, God, and the Son of Man, Jesus. That's it. There is one thing missing, though, in chapters 4 and 5. As we see in the story of Daniel chapter 7 verses 9 through 14. What's missing is the beast being judged. But best bet, that is yet to come. And you will see that over the course of the rest of this book. But if you get nothing else from this study, but that this is a glorious scene of God and a coronation of Jesus, then you have understood Revelation chapter 4 and 5. Now, turn to Revelation chapter 4, and we're going to go ahead and read it. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 5. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. After this, I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the voice, which I heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, "Come up here. And I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven, with one seated on the throne. And he who sat there had the appearance like the appearance of jasper and carnelian. And around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones. And seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments, and with golden crowns on their head. From the throne came flashes of lightning, and rumblings, and peals of thunder. And before the throne were burning 7 torches of fire, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are 4 living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature, like a lion, and the second living creature, like an ox. The third living creature, with a face of a man, and the fourth living creature, like an eagle in flight. And the 4 living creatures, each of them with 6 wings, full of eyes around and within, and day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to Him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before Him who is seated on the throne and worship Him who lives forever. They cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are You, O our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for You created all things, and by Your will they existed and were created." Then I saw in the right hand of Him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that He can open the scroll and its 7 seals." And between the throne and the 4 living creatures among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent out into the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Then I looked, and I heard around the throne the living creatures and the elders, the voice of many angels, the numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. This is our text for this evening. Here in Revelation chapter 4 and 5, the thing that probably strikes everybody first is the concept of the throne scene. And in this throne scene, you see precious metals and you see peals of thunder and flashes of lightning. You hear the rumblings. And as you look into it, it's pretty amazing what you see. But here's my first question. What benefit should Christians derive from a glimpse of God on His throne? Why does that help us at all? Okay, when you see God and He's on a throne, you know He's in charge. And you know He's ruling. But here's why that would be important. It's because when chaos happens and things happen on earth and you wonder, why is this bad thing happening to me? You wonder, is God powerful enough to do something about it? And seeing Him in a glimpse on His throne, you know that He is powerful. And you know that He is actually in charge and that nothing escapes His sovereignty. So whatever you're going through, it doesn't matter because it's smaller than the power of God and His dominion. And you know that you are under His control. That is why it is good to see God on His throne. Why else is it good to see a glimpse of God on His throne? What? The saved. What about the saved? Okay, you're saying if you're seeing God on His throne, that means you're there. That's a pretty great feeling. That's pretty awesome. But this was written so that we could see it before we get there. And I think that's part of the reason, is because we want to be there then. What is happening in this passage as you're getting just a glimpse of heaven? Just a glimpse. In 20 verses or less, you're getting a glimpse of the finish line. You're getting a glimpse of why this is worth it. Why you want to be there. Why you want to be saved. John at this point is painting a picture of the finish line. And he's doing that for us. Okay, what else? Why else would it be good to get a glimpse of God on His throne? Go ahead.
Strengthens your hope.
Absolutely. Exactly for the same reason of it's painting the picture in front of you, as it strengthens your hope. It lets you know this is real. And what you're hoping in isn't just some flippant wish. There's something to this. And it's having that security that helps you walk through the times of insecurity. It's having that confidence that helps you walk through the times where you're completely unconfident. Here's another thing. When you see the throne, as I read this, I'm pretty struck with awe. I'm just reading it. Imagine seeing it. What would you think? What would you feel if you were in this throne scene? You got to see with your very own eyes what John is seeing. I'd only have one letter, one word to come out of my mouth. Wow. Or any variation thereof, because that's about all that I could probably express. If I could express anything at all. I'd just be so overwhelmed about just how awesome this is. And it's good to see how awesome it is. Because the throne room that you see represents the one who sits on it. That's true even if you're sitting in an earthly throne room. I mean, some of the most well-decorated, immaculate places on earth belong to kings. And it's partially because they've got the money to do it. It's partially because it is true. What you see is a representative of them. This is a picture of the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles. It's a beautiful place. I hope to see it with my own eyes one day to know that it is beautiful as it seems. And Dave Good's looking at me and nodding his head. And this, I want to tell you a story about this hall though, because as immaculate and golden and beautiful as it is, there was, I think it was Louis XVI, and it is right in the middle, well, at the beginning of the French Revolution. And the peasants who are not able to feed themselves are coming to Louis XVI and they're saying, "We can't eat and you need to do something about that." And so as they're staging this protest, this formal sit-in, guess where he lets them in? Right here. It's because he wants to show them something about himself because of the place in which he lives. And what he's wanting to show you is, I've got money. I am powerful. I am decadent. And for that, they severed his head. It didn't end up very well for him. But he wanted to represent something about himself by where he sat. Well, there is something about God that you're supposed to see in this throne room in which you're seeing. But it is not that of just simple wasteful decadence. It is that of power and that of glory. And when you see power and glory and that which the angels are singing in holy, 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 in this throne room, you're getting a picture of God Himself. And that's part of why it's good for us to see this, is because in looking to this throne room, we learn a little bit more about God. But here, let me show you one other thing that I find really interesting. Did any of you feel a little like, what on earth is he describing here as he was describing some of the creatures? All right, eyes in front and back and around and within, and they've got what were they? They were the body of what? A lion, and they had the face of a man and like an eagle in flight. What was the other one? An ox. Okay, yeah. So they're like these really strange-looking creatures. I'm going to show you something from another king's throne room. This king is Sennacherib, who you might know from the Old Testament. In his throne room, there was this monument. By the way, you guys are in a really cool spot, because this exact image, this exact piece, is sitting right up in Chicago at the Oriental Eastern Museum or whatever that is. It's on the University of Chicago. It's sitting right up in Chicago. And I got to go up and see this thing. It is huge. It is huge and it is heavy. And he had this sitting in his throne. And by the way, I want you to notice what you're looking at. You are looking at something that has the body of an ox, the face of a man, and do you see the wings? 1, 2, 3, 4, I count at least 5. Does that sound familiar? See, Sennacherib would want something like this in his throne room because when you walk into it, you go, whoa. That thing's big and kind of scary looking, if nothing else weird, or heavenly. He wanted his throne room to look like something heavenly. This actually turns into a little bit of a study of angels, by the way, because When you think seraphim, what do you think? Something that looks like a man and has six wings. That's what seraphim are. When you think of cherubim, what do you think? Babies. That was, yeah, if ever you see cherubs pictured, they're little chubby white babies with tiny little wings on their backs. That's what you think of when you think of cherubs, right? This is a cherub. This is a cherubim. They were composite creatures with wings, and they were big. And so part of what you're getting when you're looking into God's throne room is you're getting angels, but you're also getting these big, scary, powerful-looking creatures. And what are they doing? They're not just mute stone pieces created by some artist. They are alive, and they are singing. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. That is what fills His throne room. And again, what you see in the throne room is representative of the one who sits on the throne. You're supposed to see power. You're supposed to be struck with awe. And you're supposed to wonder, wow, what a scene. And so I think it's really good for us to get a glimpse of what is in the throne room of God, because there's a lot of power to it, to have confidence. One more thing to add is it adds reverent fear for those who are faithful. It adds expectant fear to those who are faithless. You don't want to mess with this God. You don't want to go against the God who has four of these in His throne room and myriads of myriads and thousands upon thousands. You don't want to go against that God. Yet, what we didn't see from the comparison of Daniel chapter 4, or Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 through 14, what we didn't see is the judgment that's coming. And as you're getting a glimpse of this throne room, what you get is that you know that it's coming. And that answer to your question of the evils of this earth and when something is going to happen about it gets a glimpse from here in this throne room. But there's one other thing that I find really fascinating about this throne room. So around the throne there was a rainbow, and it was a rainbow like emerald, and there were precious stones, and then there was something around the throne. Did you catch what that was? It was a sea of glass. And I want to talk to you about that sea of glass for just a second. Because this, I think, is what we picture when we think sea of glass. It's reflective. It's beautiful, it's placid, it's glorious. That's what has always come to my mind when I think sea of glass. Is that about, I mean, even if it's more clear and a little less colorful than that, is that about what you think when you think sea of glass? Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Not the skiing part. Yeah. And so to me, when I think of this glassy sea, for a long time I thought like the biggest placid lake you've ever seen, without any ripples whatsoever. But this glassy sea might not be the picture of tranquility that we've always had in mind. It might look something more like this. And here's why. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 4, verse 6. I mean, you're already there, but read with me Revelation chapter 4, verse 6. It simply says, "And before the throne there was a sea, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal." And you think beauty. But that same sea is found again. And this time in Revelation chapter 15, verse 2. Revelation chapter 15 in verse 2. Does anyone happen to have a New King James Version on them? Yes? Okay. Read to me Revelation chapter 15 and verse 2. Perfect, thank you. So you see this sea, except this time it's wreathed in fire, and where are the saints? They're on it, as if crossing. Now turn to Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. The sea that you find in Revelation chapter 4 is not there by the time you get to Revelation chapter 21. Curious, no? Here's why. When the ancients saw the sea, or thought of the sea, what they thought the sea was chaos and death. There was nothing tranquil about it. It was the image of pain, death, and chaos. So, I want you to go back in time with me just a little bit. To the crossing of the Red Sea. In the crossing of the Red Sea, the Israelites have come out of Egypt. And as they've come out of Egypt, Pharaoh has finally said, fine, get out of here. So they take their unleavened bread and they start walking along. Now, by the way, they don't start walking up the coastline right up to Canaan. They go to the Red Sea. And as they go to the Red Sea, Pharaoh eventually goes, man, that was really dumb. I want them to come back. So he starts chasing them with his army. And as he's chasing with his army, they have worked their way into this spot that they can't run. They have the army of Pharaoh on one side and they have the Red Sea on the other. Do you know what they see on both sides? They see death. They see chaos, inevitable death on both sides. But what does God do? By the way, He protects them with fire, with a wall of fire. Do you remember that? And then what does He do? He parts the sea and brings them across in safety. Here in Revelation, you get that very same thing. You see the sea, and we think we are on like the shoreline, and we're standing next to the throne of God, and we're just looking out at this beautiful sea that we get to be on oceanfront property for the rest of eternity. But that's probably not the image. In fact, what's probably going on is there's the throne room of God and a glassy sea, and I'm looking at it from a distance. And I see the troubles of earth behind me, and I see the glassy sea in front of me. And what do I see? Death on both sides. But the story of Revelation, the story of God's people, is that He brings them across safely. He brings them to Himself. And then dismisses the sea so that they can always be in safety. That is the story of Revelation. And it's not the only time. Think of creation. The story of creation. In which, on the first day, before there was anything, he said there was void over the deep and over the waters. And then He said, let there be light. But after that, try to picture this. God, it says, separates the waters from the waters, and then He parts the waters and makes dry land appear. Try to picture that. That is cool. Except it's not just cool. It is a story, even from the beginning, of, again, think water, think chaos. God is parting chaos to make a place for His people. And then you see it in the Red Sea. And then you see it as Joshua is crossing over the Jordan, in which once again, God parts the waters to bring His people safely to Himself. Now finally in Revelation, there is this glassy sea, and God again is parting the waters to bring His people through chaos safely to Himself. This isn't just a picturesque scene. This is a scene of God saving in chaos. And it is a story of hope. Time will fail me to keep talking about this, so I'm going to go ahead and move on. So we're going to talk about now chapter 5. Chapter 5, it says, the one sitting on the throne has this scroll, and the scroll is sealed 7 times. And someone needs to open these, so they look everywhere. And there's no one in heaven and on earth or under the earth. By the way, that's everybody. And there's no one found. And you start to wonder, as John begins to weep, why is he weeping? These scrolls need to be opened in order for the judgment of God, the edict of God, to pass. And so they're looking for this one. And John starts to weep, and very soon, one looks at him and says, don't cry, John. Don't cry anymore. Because the Lion of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered. And he can open the scroll and it's sealed. Behold, the Lion. Except it doesn't really look like a lion. At all. Do you find that a little odd? That when he says, behold the Lion of Judah who has conquered, and all of a sudden the next thing you see is a lamb. And not just any lamb, by the way. I mean, this is a cute little lamb, but this is a lamb who is standing as if slain. So it's like a wounded lamb. And even more weird, and we don't have to get into this, is the 7 horns and the 7 eyes. Like, this is a funky looking lamb here. But this lamb, the Lion, the Root of David, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, is the one who is also pronounced worthy. So we're going to talk about some of those descriptions for a little while. The Lion of the tribe of Judah. This is going all the way back to the end of Genesis. The end of Genesis, when Israel is finally blessing all of his sons. And the birthright is being stripped from Reuben because Reuben was a sexually immoral man. And so the right is passing on past him. And then there's Simeon and Levi. And it's passing from them too because of what Jeremy was just teaching us on Sunday morning and the slaughter that they had of the city of Shechem and their vengeance. And so it's coming to son number 4, Judah. And what is said to Judah is that he is going to be the one to rule. Inscriptions of lions. Ever since then, there has been this anticipation of a king to come from Judah. And from Judah would be this ruler who would be the ruler of all rulers, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. And you kind of think that it's David. David came from Judah. David was a mighty king, a king of after God's own heart. And probably the king after all other kings are judged. But it's not David. It's going to come through David. It's Jesus. So finally here in this scene, as you're getting a picture of the Lamb, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, you're supposed to be recalling all of that expectation of this king who is going to be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and the one who is going to rule everything. He has arrived. And again, this is his coronation. This is where he is receiving his kingdom and dominion. But you also see him standing as those slain. Why, I ask, do you think he's standing as if slain? Okay, because this was a lamb that was an offering to God. You kind of get those Old Testament images of a sacrificial lamb. But Jesus literally was offered to God. This isn't a symbol. He did die. And that's why he's standing as if slain. Yet even in his death, he triumphed. Even in his death, the greatest enemy of mankind could not conquer him. And he broke the bars of death and taunted it on its way out, kind of thing. Even in his death was found the greatest victory. In fact, it gave him access to being the king. And so, this is calling not upon... This slaying is the very thing that describes him as worthy. Because he was willing to die for you and for me. Because he was willing to make one nation from all peoples and tongues and nations and places and times, he was willing to make one kingdom. And we are so thankful to have been purchased by his blood that that is possible. And so they cry out, "Worthy is the Lamb. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Worthy to receive power and glory and dominion and wealth." Does the wealth thing catch you off guard? Like, glory and dominion and power and wealth. Okay. He's kind of got everything. But remember that this book of Revelation isn't just about exalting Jesus. It's about shaming those who are in the competition. And the competition at this point are kings who consider themselves worthy of glory and dominion and power and wealth. So let's talk now. Let's move on. And we're going to talk about hymns for just a second. And I'm going to eventually ask this question. Why are songs so important for Christians? But before we do, what I want to tell you is that songs, hymns, were frequently used in the worship of Caesar as God. And I'm sorry, I didn't bring them with me. I've got several examples. If you want, I can just send those to you after class. Just send me a text message or an email. But in these, the songs that you hear in Revelation chapter 4 and 5 sound so eerily similar to the songs that are sung about Caesars as gods. And that kind of catches you off guard a little bit, because we read that and we think, wow, what blasphemy. But they would read this and think, what blasphemy. Remember that letter that I read? It was a letter from Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan. And he was investigating Christians and putting them to death. And as he was investigating Christians and putting them to death, he was trying to figure out the sum of what Christians are all about. And as he was trying to figure out the sum of what Christians are all about, what he said was, they simply try to dedicate themselves to being moral, to not violate a trust, or to forgive those who have violated trust against them, or to be committed to only one spouse, or to take of a simple meal. Here's another thing that he said, and they sing a hymn to Jesus as if to a god. See, they hear these hymns about Jesus and they think, what blasphemy for this guy who thinks he's a god. There's only one man who's a god in their eyes, and that is Caesar. Yet, when you hear, hymns are very infrequently used in apocalyptic literature. And again, as we talked about apocalyptic literature as a genre, there's a lot of things that you can expect. From symbols, to prophetic language, to numbers and everything else. Like, there's a lot of things about it that you can anticipate. But the one thing that you would never expect to find in apocalyptic literature is hymns. You don't see these anywhere else. But you find them in Revelation. Why? Because of the enemy for whom the Revelation was written. Because of the problem that it addresses. And so you find hymns. And hymns and hymns. So I'm going to ask this question. Why are songs so important for Christians? Hope. The various words that were used about a glimpse of heaven. How do songs give hope? Mm-hmm. And I like the concept of that word picture, by the way, because of in all the poetry of it and all the beauty of it, it almost like it amplifies that picture so that you get a more vivid scene of hope when you're singing. Go ahead. What? All right. Someone's going to Ephesians chapter 5 and Colossians chapter 3. Speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, making melody in your hearts to the Lord. Or, as Colossians says, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. We need songs. We need songs. And so part of singing, I would hope the majority of singing, is about God. It's about praising Him and about lifting Him up. But when we sing, we are encouraging each other. We are building each other up. We are speaking and admonishing one another. We are teaching one another through song. And that's something that is so powerful to do as a group, as a collective. Because one, in singing, it means that you're not alone. It gives you some hope. And it is the source of encouragement to lift you up from someone else when you yourself are stumbling. That is why songs are so powerful. Why else are songs so important for Christians? Go ahead. The concept of a hymn. Hymns were, in the ancient world, frequently sung of victors in battle. And we sing hymns about Christ, the victorious one. And they remind us of the triumph that He had and the sacrifice that He offered. It reminds us about the man who is neither myth nor legend, but is the true victorious one. And we need that reminder because it impacts us so powerfully. So they serve to tell a story. They serve to give hope. They serve to encourage others. Why else are songs so important for Christians?
Josh, I think the whole thing we talked about today is about the contrast between the glory of heaven, the glory of Christ, mm-hmm. and what He has done even there. Contrary to living on this earth with all the persecution, of course, more for that first century group than for us.
Sure. Oh yeah, it's gonna be terrible for these. Yeah. And that from Peter.
So I think, to me, what these folks were going through, we're not less than the stuff that we hear on TV today and things. These people were being put on stakes and lit on fire in their own state.
Yeah. That is all absolutely true. And as we're running out of time, I'm going to give you a verse of a song. Holy, 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 though the darkness hide thee, though the eye of sinful man thy glory may not see, only thou art holy, there is none beside thee, perfect in power, in love, and purity. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, All thy works shall praise thy name in earth and sky and sea. Holy, 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 merciful and mighty, God over all and blessed eternally. When you see the picture of God, when you are able to sing about Him, it can even make the troubles of earth, the darkness, seem to pass away. So that is Revelation chapters 4 and 5. The Lamb was found and He's now able to open the seals. And what we're going to study next is when He opened those seals and what you find when He does. Thanks for studying with me.